This is Red Ice Radio. From the apparent to the esoteric. RedIceCreations.com.
Welcome to Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren. Our website is RedIceCreations.com. And today we are going to wrap up our series on Zionism and Multiculturalism together with writer Israel Shamir, who is with us to share his perspective from Russia. He is a champion of the one man, one vote, one state solution, seeking to unite Palestine and Israel in one democratic state. Shamir's work and that of his contributors speaks to aspirations of both the Israelis and the Palestinians seeking an end to the bloodshed. He has published and self-published a number of books which have been translated into a range of languages. Shamir has also lived in Sweden on and off and has suffered many ad hominem attacks by our mainstream media, who constantly try to discredit him and his message by calling him anti-Semite and a Holocaust denier. His website is israelshamir.net, where you can read more about his views on Israel, Palestine and the Jewish people. Welcome to Red Ice Radio, Israel Shamir. It is great to talk to you. Thank you for taking the time to spending some of your time with us. It's great to have you with us on the line.
Thank you very much, Henrik, and hello the audience.
Absolutely. We're looking forward to hearing more from you about this. We're obviously here doing a series on Zionism and multiculturalism, and I'd like to hear a little bit from your perspective here at the outset, so we kind of know where you're coming from, I guess. Tell us just briefly about your situation in terms of where you're coming from in terms of the political spectrum, and if you can give us a brief little outline of what you think about Zionism, Israel.
The first thing, that would be very long kind of life story, which would bore every listener. So I'll just cut it short, and I say that politically, that's difficult now to describe oneself. Once upon a time, one could say left, one could say right, and things made sense. But nowadays, left and right makes very, very little sense, as a matter of fact. We see that there are people who are supposed to be on the left, but they do not care about workers. And there are people on the right, but they do not want to do endless wars for the very wealthy. So the old terminology is a little bit kind of on the loose side. I would say that there are some few things which are, let's say, more or less important. What is the position of a man or a woman towards the American empire? That is, I think, a very important question. And another one, what's one position towards Israel and Palestine? That, I think, also is very, very important take. The third one, I would say, it's a question of whether one believes that rich should be as rich as they can make it. That is a question of privatization nationalization, some sort of socialism or some sort of capitalism. And then another additional important point is the relationship to the church, its relation to tradition, to family. So you see, all those things are very, very different. And the position on the left and on the right really does not help you to define the person.
Of course not. It's and you're right, Israel. I think that the political landscape have changed so drastically in the last few years that things have kind of they're kind of a bit upside down. And at the end of it, I don't know. Maybe that's a pretty good idea, actually, because I don't like to see people get stuck either in the left or the right. This is about, I guess, being rational to the individual topics, as it were, Israel.
Yes, yes. Like, for instance, look, if we speak about Sweden, my sympathy would be always to the left, let's say, historically speaking. But now I see that the left made such peculiar arrangements with people who are whom I dislike very much. Like, for instance, this Expo magazine, which is some sort of fighting tool of the Jewish lobby in the United States. And that's very difficult to like. or people who are basically engaged mainly in breaking family, in turning kind of dead gendering people, which is also I don't think is right. So, and on the other hand, the left of Sweden sends Swedish soldiers to Afghanistan.
Right.
So all those things really make one doubt very much whether it's really a good idea to think in the old terms. We should really start to look in totally, totally different way.
Absolutely. I mean, again, the old so-called, you know, conservative party here in Sweden, the moderate party, they're calling themselves the New Workers Party now. Everything is upside down, but we can leave that to the side for now, Israel. And,
exactly.
And maybe you can just tell us a little bit about how you, your take on Zionism, obviously, and also how you think that has become one of the most powerful and to, you know, unknown to most people, ideologies or groups in the world, Israel.
Yes, that's very, very interesting thing indeed, yes. Well, very often when people say Zionists, they basically mean Jews. So it's just for a kind of reason of political correctness or because of fear of hate laws, which were enforced all over many countries. People are worried, would never kind of speak up their mind, and that's why they prefer to speak about Zionists. But, well, Zionism is some kind of a case of Jewish nationalism, of extreme Jewish nationalism, which has many, many interesting and obviously uncomfortable for others ways to work. Historically, obviously, it's very, very interesting seeing how it happened. There was a time in the 19th century when the Jews were set free from the rule of the rabbis. And that was actually a very, very big, exciting moment in the Jewish life, when all of a sudden the walls of ghetto were breached and people were able to live their life as they like. But then eventually, with years and years, some sort of Jewish setup began to take place again. And that is something that, let's say, in the beginning of 20th century, it would be difficult to believe that in 21st century, this thing still works, is still active. Nowadays, Jewry, in my view, it is some sort of setup similar in a way to, let's say, Catholic Church. Catholic Church, we know what is it. Yes, it exists. I mean, they have banks, they have churches, they have spiritual element, they have youth movement and whatnot. Now, Jewry is much smaller than the Catholic Church, but still it's quite powerful because it has its spiritual dimension and because it has its capital, which is also not too small, and it has some other kind of vested interests. Now, Zionism is basically just one of the directions that the Jewry acts, and I don't know whether it is the most important one. So that's roughly where I find myself. Though it's obviously, I can talk forever about what happens in Israel and Palestine.
Sure.
Very painful kind of stuff, very painful.
Yeah.
But it would be, I think, a mistake to limit it only to that.
Absolutely. And one thing that I've asked other guests here, which I think is an important point as well, and I'd like your take on it, are all Jews Zionists and are all Zionists Jews?
No. Not all Jews Zionists, not all Zionists Jews. But I tell you more. Not every good Jew is a Zionist or non-Zionist or anti-Zionist. Like with the left and right, you know, those things have many, many different ways to understand. There could be some people who are Zionists and what else, but still they are kind of good people and involved, and they do not feel themselves superior to anybody else. Basically, like, for instance, I think always about one of my uncles who is a farmer in Be'er Tuvia village in Israel. And he is kind of, you know, big guy, milking cows all the day long. He has some 70 cows. You know, I mean, you ask him, Zionist? Yeah, sure, Zionist. But that's not something that makes him, you know, totally crazy. On the other hand, there are such people as George Soros, who is supposed to be anti-Zionist. But I mean, I can't really find much positive to say about this guy. Or for instance, Madoff, the great cheat of New York, you know, man who stole $50 billion, they say. Well, he's not a Zionist, but I mean, surely allows any time. So, you know, yeah, Zionism is bad for sure. But let's say for grown-ups, it's clear that Zionism is not the old story.
Right, right. So if we set Zionism apart or we separate it from the Jewish people as a race, obviously, then let's try to break down a little bit what Zionism is. Is it an ideology, a group, or is it a form of religion, Israel? What would you say?
Well, in my view, Zionism is just one of ideologies which are operated by Jews. Jews or the Jews or Jewry, and I mean as a collective, in the same way as let's separate Catholic Church and separate Catholics. Catholics as human beings and Catholic Church as an entity. So in the same very way, the Jews also have an entity of their own. So this entity is being manifested by various ways. One of them is Zionism. Let's put it in such a way. It's ideology, yes. For some people, it is some sort of profane religion, but that's something you can say about every ideology. But what I try to stress is that Jews do so many other things too. They're not kind of doing only Zionism in its direct connection. But people started to say usually nowadays Zionism, they mean the whole complex of Jewish activities.
Yeah. So how much do you see that this ties back to the Bible or the Torah then? And as an extension of that, what can you say about the goals of Zionism?
Yes, what would be the goal of the Catholic Church? Can you possibly answer this question?
It seems to be domineering the world, at least in the past. I don't know what the role is today, but...
Well, I'm sure they would not answer it in such a way, would they?
Sure, sure. Of course, they would never admit that.
No. So, you know, they have, let's say, Jews like Catholics, they have the idea of, let's say, domineering in ideological, spiritual way. It's not the same as physical dominance. Yes, the desire to dominate spiritually, yes, for sure, no doubt. But that's how I see it.
Absolutely. But isn't that a spiritual colonization, if you will? Isn't that another, way of getting into the, you know, if you're getting into the heads of people and try to control their spirituality, then that's not much different from trying to control the world in another way, isn't it?
Well, when we say control the world, people do not really usually understand what you want to say. And then they start to imagine something like a vast dictatorship with so many secret services that control it. But basically, as I say, like Catholic Church, the Jews want to control the world spiritually. They want to guide the world. But again, the question is whether this guidance is good for the people. And that is something that obviously there could be different answers.
Absolutely. And how, this is a difficult question, but how aligned do you think everybody is to this ideology? I've read quite a bit in terms of obviously people debating this issue from different sides of the fence, so to speak, and they try to say that the programming, if you will, lies in the culture of Judaism, while other people say that this is strictly bound to the political ideology of Zionism. But in one sense, some people seem to suggest that this is very centrally aligned and everybody is on the same page. But would you agree with that? Or do you see that there's a lot of infighting or differences happening as well in the world of Zionist ideology?
Yes, there are differences. I would always suggest to look at the bottom line. And whenever I come across somebody and he tells me about his views, I always try to get first to the bottom line and to see where we are, whether we are on the same page, as you put it well. I know, for instance, people who call themselves socialists and communists and whatnot. And then they would give you good socialist and communist reasons why Palestinians should be subjugated and why Jews should rule in Palestine. Then I understand it is some sort of mimicry, it's some sort of camouflage, some sort of cheating me and trying to cheat other people. And then I meet people who are on the right, and then they would give their own answer why it should be done. And actually, what is interesting is that now we see also far right, which became totally pro-Zionist. That is something that didn't exist before.
That's but now, right.
You know, Sweden Demokraterna,
they're pro-Zionist.
Violently Zionist.
Yeah, incredible, isn't it? I mean, how did this, again, we're back to that point that you brought up earlier in that sense, Israel. You mentioned that the left and the right are kind of all upside down right now. I've been thinking about this for a long time. And in the past, obviously, people connected right wing with you know, Nazi ideology, if you will, in that sense. But yeah, Now these seem to have kind of blurred, if you will, these lines. What is happening then?
Yes, that's very interesting. That's why I said, kind of look at the bottom line. So if you see that the party became basically Zionized, then you understand they can't be up to no good. It doesn't matter what else they say about the rest, because it means they sold their souls. So, I mean, and that's something that happens with many left and right parties all over Europe. You know that such practically fascist people like Fini in Italy also went to Israel, kissed Ariel Sharon, took pictures in Yad Vashem in the Jewish Holocaust Museum. So we see, and obviously about the left, there is not much to speak about. They're also quite similar. So we really experience very interesting thing when so many people feel that it is in their best interests, let's say, to conform to the Jewish desires.
Yeah. So what do you think is so important about the land of Palestine? Why do the Zionist elite want it so bad?
Well, you know, that is a very good question. And there could be many different answers. I don't really, I'm not sure that which answer would be the best. For some people, it's like basically a symbol. For some people, it's, let's say, a symbol of Jewish ascendancy, owning the most important spiritual site, the tomb of Christ, the empty tomb of Christ, the place where the Prophet Muhammad went to heaven, the Temple of Solomon, whatever else, one of the most important pilgrimage places, and one that was always very important. You know, Crusaders fought for it, and Arabs regained it eventually, and now the Jews have it, and that's obviously one of the, let's say, tools of mental dominance. So that is also true. But for people who think in different ways, in a way, it's like a banner, like a flag saying, well, here we are, we've got what we want. And then it's you can speak about it like a ring of power, something that allows the Jewish rulers, the Jewish leaders, to control all the various Jews and pull them together. Because otherwise, without it, it's very probable that the Jews would totally assimilate and disappear. Like, for instance, you know, Huguenots who came to Sweden some 200-300 years ago. You find in the families, they would say, let's say, one of our ancestors is a Huguenot. Mm-hmm. But they really are not, they're not a community in Sweden, right?
Right.
You know what I speak about, the French Protestants, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So in the same very way, the Jews would also assimilate, and that would be the end of it. But some people feel and felt that it would be pity to lose such tool, which could be a wonderfully powerful tool. And in order to control the tool, they bring forth the Holy Land. So it has also this aspect.
Right, because, I mean, if you do look far back into history enough, somewhere it kind of also turns into a form of mythology, if you will. And so do you think that the Bible has it correct when it talks about the Hebrew, you know, people controlling that particular area before the Arabs? And if so, can this ever be historically, you know, validated in one way or another?
No, I think that has practically no meaning at all. That's really not something that we have anything to think about. That I think is quite irrelevant. The Bible, it's a question of how you read the Bible. For Christians, Bible is very simple thing, you know. I mean, not simple, but I mean clear cut. Now, what is Israel? Israel, for a Christian, is the church. The church is Israel. And if you go to Sunday, on Sunday to church, you know that's kind of what we Christians think about it, about Israel being the church. And the Jewish claim that they are Israel, for a Christian, it's kind of outdated claim. Mm. It's like, let's say, a claim of Danish king to rule over Sweden.
Right, right.
Okay, like you had your chance, but I mean, that was some hundreds of years ago. Not valid anymore.
Right. Well, it's a good point. Things become more difficult when one puts it in that kind of context. That's right. So how do you see that anti-Semitism, you know, is being used now to silence valid criticism of Zionism, Israel?
You know, I do not believe that anti-Semitism exists even. In my opinion, it's a total invention. And how do we know that it is invention? In a very simple way, the word anti-Semitism was invented in 1880s, something like that. But people tell us all the time, you hear it every day or every second day, that anti-Semitism is eternal, something that always exists. So if it always exists, why the word was invented only in 1880? And why then all this term is so time-limited? There are no people who would describe themselves as anti-Semites, probably. So it became, again, some kind of pejorative title for people who do not like Jewish policies. And I think that is perfectly valid to dislike Jewish policies, like it is perfectly valid to dislike Catholic Church policies, or to dislike policy of Sweden or America or whatever. So, I mean, it's not like Jews are the only entity which can't be criticized. That would be very strange. So, obviously, the Jewish action calls for some reaction. But to describe it by some kind of mythic hatred of Jews, this is obviously absolute fairy tale. But this fairy tale has also very interesting background. Jews invented the idea that they are being hated by everybody really long time ago. It's not like the idea is from yesterday. You can find in the Jewish religious books that they say that the Mount Sinai, where Moses received the Ten Commandments, is called Sinai because of the word sin'ah, hatred, because God imposed hatred between Jews and non-Jews. So that is the Jewish view. But how do Jews themselves explain why there is this hatred? The Jews explain it in a very simple way. Non-Jews are envious of Jews. Why they are envious of Jews? Because Jews have access to God, and non-Jews have no access to God. That is the Jewish view. Now, you understand now, after I told you that this is all that very ridiculous idea that a Swede who is a member of Lutheran Church or a Russian who is a member of his own Russian church have as much access to God as a Jew who goes to his synagogue, or maybe more or maybe less, depends on kind of individual qualities. So the idea that Jews are the only people with access to God, that is a really, really ridiculous idea. And in other words, there is no reason to be envious of Jews. Nothing to be envious. And I don't know of anybody who is envious of Jews, as a matter of fact.
Well, I mean, then you must also accept that, you know, the God that the Hebrews and the Jews, you know, worship in that sense also is, you know, my or other people gods as well. I mean, it's their mythology, right? And it's 2,000 years old and one doesn't have to agree with that. There's other stories out there about gods and what have you. So that doesn't make sense at all to me, actually.
Well, I see it in a kind of simple way. That well, we can call different names for different things, but the idea that there is God, that is something that is quite universal. I think that's something that you can understand as well as anybody else without going to mythology. And the idea whether we have contact with God, whether God listens to us. For a Christian, the answer is yes. And St. Paul, one of the founders of Christianity, he said that we don't have any reason to be envious of Jews or to be angry with Jews or to be anything about Jews, because everything they had, we have now. We, meaning the Christian church.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I see it, more or less.
Now, there's another interesting point here as well in terms of the idea of a people or a culture having no land. How do you think that have influenced the Jewish culture or the Jewish people that have been, you know, in different parts of the European continent and migrated in some countries they've been thrown out of in the past and so forth as well? Do you think that has something to do with the problematic situation that we're faced with right now, Israel?
But, you know, we don't have to think about Jews like about some real nation which is supposed to have some real land. Think it is about, let's say, redheads. You know, redheads have no land.
Right.
Okay, well, you know, but so what? And obviously, if one wants very much, one can find this, create a whole martyrology of redheads who were persecuted and ill-treated everywhere. Here in Russia, where I am now, I haven't heard it, I must admit, for the last 20 years. But once upon a time, they had a lot of ways, a lot of kind of nasty things to say about redheads. But no, redheads somehow survived it. I didn't notice any redhead that would, you know, suffer because of that all that very much.
So I guess what you're saying in one way is that you might agree with the title of Shlomo Zand's book, The Invention of the Jewish Race, right?
Yes, I think Shlomo Zand, I think, put it very well. Yes, I think this idea is anyway, it's good as a way of putting it, saying, but that's also not different from what it was said by Karl Marx and by other people who said that Jews is some sort of, it's not a real thing, it's not a nation, it's not people. When we say Jewish people, it's in the same very way as we say the Muslim Ummah, which is also people from Muslims, you know, or the Christian folk. So those things are not really, they haven't got direct meaning. Jews is something that is, let's say, has very strong ideological and religious component. And the idea that they should have some land is, as I say, very, very peculiar. I think also it's much of misunderstanding which began with rise of political Zionism when people started to speak about it.
So I guess in one sense, what we're trying to get to here, Israel, is we're trying to define, you know, is it a race? Is it a culture? Is it an ideology and an idea? I guess as all things are, though, if you go back far enough into history, things kind of disintegrate. I mean, if you look at the concept of Sweden, for instance, we had different tribes, if you will, up here, different kinds of people, the Goths and those who would call themselves the Swedes today. And this was before the nation of Sweden was formed, if you will. And then we also had different waves of immigration from different parts of Europe and so forth as well. So if you go back far enough, it becomes difficult. But how do you see that applying to to Judaism or Jewish people then in that sense? Are we using the wrong words to describe them as a people or as a culture, or where's the problem there, do you think?
Well, yeah, it's not that there is some problem, but let's say we don't have to see it as a problem. There is an element, there is a group which has a way of acting in their own interests. That's sounds kind of to be quite simple thing. So there is a group that acts in kind of for its own interests in order to get maximum of resources and to achieve eventually spiritual superiority. So there is such a group. Now, a person who is born in this group may stay with this group or go away from this group. Once upon a time, it was very difficult to leave. It would be connected with some terrible deprivations, or some would be killed by the group. You know, many people born Jews who tried to go away were eventually killed by the Jewish leaders. But nowadays, it's not very difficult to leave. It's, you know, something that's quite possible. Hmm. So in a way, it is, yes, it is an organization. And this organization, one could be a member of, or one can really care a little bit about it. So yes, it is one of those marginal things, but as I said, comparison with the Catholic Church would kind of give you some indication in the way it acts, like a financial institution, like mutual help, and it has some purpose and has some ideas. And I mean, nothing kind of to be all that scared about. The problem is that Jewish ideology, in my view, is very, very troublesome. I mean, I'm not very fond of Jewish ideology at all. The Jewish ideology saying that, let's say, the Jews should be so much full of light, while everybody else should be full of dark. In my way, you know, this idea of light and dark is a little bit too Manichaean, if you see what I mean.
Right, right. So is that another, I mean, I don't know if this is then racially oriented, culturally oriented and so forth, but is that another kind of racism then, would you say, or what? What is it?
Well, I don't know. The word racism is not really out of my dictionary. I don't use it because this word became now, they use it now so much on every occasion against everybody.
Sure.
That it lost meaning, you know. It just became one of those very meaningless words, like the word witch in 18th century.
Ah, I see what you mean. Good point.
You say witch, everybody says, oh, let's kill the witch. But I mean, and the same with racism nowadays. It's also a word of no meaning. About Jews, well, there is some ethnic element, but I don't know to which extent this ethnic element is decisive, because Jews of different countries usually dislike each other. It's not like, you know, a Jew from Morocco and Jew from Sweden would feel any affinity to each other. Mm-hmm. Not at all. As a matter of fact, if anything, there would be usually great dislike. So, you know, that's obviously something that, let's say, undermines the concept of a race or kind of ethnic unity. You know, there are many different ways to explain it. If somebody is interested in, let's say, the way it came to exist, and that's, for instance, what Shlomo Zand wrote, and before Shlomo Zand, many other people tried to describe it in different ways. It's also a very good idea to always remember words of Karl Marx, who tried to demystify Jews very well. And he said, well, you know, it doesn't matter. I mean, what they believe in is money. That's what they worship. Their God is greed. And the best thing to do is to void it, to eliminate it completely by kind of eliminating it as ideology. Let's not tell you, for instance, that's also a very possible attitude. But let's say there are so many important thinkers of Europe who really thought that, let's say, Jewish ideology is something that is very good to define and to fight against. Because struggle against somebody is actually not less important than struggle for something. If you have an enemy, it's very good for you. If I'll tell you that, you'll understand what I mean, that for a long time, Christendom found that struggle against Jews is actually, it's good for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see what you mean. It's a basic group psychology idea, right? That if you do have an enemy, that strengthens the group even more. It gets tighter together, right?
Yes, well, it strengthens the group, but also it has the correct meaning, you know, because the Jews are sort of symbol of privatization, if you want, mm-hmm. of taking away things from you to themselves instead of sharing, something that is opposite to sharing. And obviously, good Christians were always against it. And so it was until eventually the ideas of economic liberalism came forth. I mean, economical liberalism as we understand the word today, so liberalism in the meaning that let rich people become even more rich and let poor be as poor as they can make it. And that was a time when attitude towards Jewish ideology changed. This change is explained by all kind of, you know, parsimonious reasons, like saying it's against racism or that so Jews would not become upset. Mm-hmm. But let's say if you look deeper, you see that the problem is not that, obviously. The problem is that the whole attitude to sharing and owning changed. That's how I would see it.
Interesting. So there's obviously lots more to say about that, and I want to try to get to the multiculturalism aspect here as well. I would like your take on that, but just briefly before we do that, I guess I want to just spend a little bit of time on the Palestine-Israel, you know, conflict, if you will. You're a supporter of the proposed one-state solution, correct?
Yes, correct. Absolutely, yes. I think that's the only thing to do. The whole idea of arguing with Jews about borders, first of all, it's very tedious. Then you never win those arguments. And then it takes you nowhere. In my opinion, the only way to do is just to undo the Jewish state, and that's it. To undo the Jewish state so it would never come back again. Undo it by democratizing the country. I can't even understand how come that there is this idea of Jewish state in Palestine. Why not Jewish state in Sweden? Why not Jewish state somewhere else? Basically, it's not really complicated. But and the idea is wrong everywhere. In my opinion, people should have equal rights, like Jews have equal rights in Sweden. Let non-Jews have equal rights in the whole land of Palestine. That's how I see it, basically. Mm.
So I don't know how you see, you know, so-called multiculturalism from your point of view, Israel. You've lived in many different countries and so forth as well. Some people, you know, have an idea that multiculturalism actually is a Zionist plot. Would you agree with that, Israel?
Well, you don't mean Zionist. You mean Jewish. You mean Jewish plot? There is such kind of idea. Yes, it was described by different people. One of them, for instance, you can find it in this kind of interesting American professor, Mark. His name escaped me this very moment. Right. Well, anyway, doesn't matter. Yes, there is such an idea. The meaning, let's say, when people say, so what do they mean? They mean that we said that there is a group of Jews who want to, let's say, prosper. That's normal. And in order to prosper, one of the things they want, they don't want to be seen as the only exclusion, as the only exception. As long as, for instance, there is a homogeneous Swedish society, and on this homogeneous society there is the only exception, that the Jews, they kind of will be seen very much. But if you import all kind of different other communities from other countries, then the Jews are not seen. And that is basically good. So that is basically the idea why people say that is good. And on the other hand, it's also psychologically, in a way, it's also true that Jews very often, let's say, moved to a country not all that tremendously long time ago, maybe two generations ago, maybe three generations ago. And they are not used to the local customs, and they don't know the local habits all that very well. So instead of, let's say, absorbing things, they say, let us kind of do it in a more simple way. Let's take American culture as a background and let everybody else living their own individual life. But obviously there is also an additional problem that basically from this point of view, Jewish attitude is not all that different from attitude of practically all immigrants. What I'll tell you now, it should be, it kind of, it's very, very sad, let's say, thing, because, but I mean, that's where we are. A person who is an outsider in the society, he would have affinity to Jews. That's kind of quite, you know, where we are. Let's say, a Muslim boy in Sweden or a Jewish boy in Sweden, they would have, to a great extent, similar attitude.
So what you're saying, Israel, is that it's a kind of a defense mechanism, actually. It's a reason for protection. There's safety in numbers, if you will. And so if you have several minorities in a country, you can kind of hide out in that, if you will.
Yes, you can hide, let's say, just to be one of the minorities, and that's all. You can also break, let's say, the monolith of the society. And when you break the monolith of society is also, it's easier to exploit the society. Now, don't forget that Jews traditionally are some sort of exploiters, not somebody who is exploited. It is an elite group. I mean, we can always say, try to say it's not so, but I mean, that's where we are. It is surely an elite group in practically every country I know of, including Sweden, including Russia, including United States. Mm.
And, now, do you believe that that happens because there is it's a self-supporting group, if you will, in that way, that if it is found out that you have, for instance, somebody who is Jewish, if you're in a position, whatever, do you think that there is, are they helping out each other more than maybe another culture would, if I put it that way?
Well, that's one of the possible explanations. That's a possible explanation. And again, it's not like they always and everywhere had it that kind of tremendously good. As a rule, not really. For instance, Sweden had no Jews at all until the second half of 19th century. Mm. So, you know, that's also not really all that kind of clear cut. There could be this reason, there could be other reasons. And there are so many various explanations that probably would kind of, you know, we would have to make a whole week to discuss it.
Sure. Of course, there's so much more to say about it, obviously. But what do you see happens to a culture then when it goes so-called multicultural? From my point of view, anyway, what I'm seeing is it's actually not turning into a multicultural culture. It's actually turning into a form of monoculture. Not only is the inherent culture in a country kind of eroding as a cause of it, but also the people who are coming in are kind of cultureless, rootless, if you will. Would you agree with that, Israel?
Well, let's say, in a way, I think it's wonderful that people have the culture that they are rooted in. I've really been to many countries. I lived in many countries. And everywhere, in every country, I was always delighted by the native ways. I spent a few years in Japan. And in Japan, I like, you know, not the high-rise in Tokyo, where people eat pizza. But I like people who sit under the cherry blossom and write poetry in Japanese. And the same in Sweden. I kind of, I have a long story of connection to Sweden. But what I like about Sweden, again, is not gay marriages, but what I like about it is people in Dalarna dancing around Maypole. So basically, everywhere I like most of all in the old traditional native ways.
Yeah.
And I think that's perfectly fine. I see no reason why it should be different, because traditional ways are obviously the best. And personally, as for me, I would like Sweden to be this kind of wonderful traditional old-style Sweden. Yes,
it's not, though, Israel. That's the problem. I mean, it is eroding, and the fact is that we do have politicians here who are actually backstabbing, if you will, the Swedish population. I've several times now been reading articles of when our political leaders travel abroad, and that they talk about how we have no culture in Sweden, and it's all, I mean, what do we have? Meatballs, and that's imported, and then we have the maypole, as you mentioned, and that's no value in that, blah, blah, blah. When, of course, we do have a rich, long history here of things that have been long suppressed in terms of both the Vikings, but even further back than that, that we're not taught in school. So it is an erosion of the cultural happening. And do you think then that that's a conscious conspiracy, if you will, of trying to make people rootless, if you will, or how do you view that?
Well, Henrik, it happens all over the world. It happens in France. It happens in Russia. It happens in Japan. You name a country, you see the same awful process of defacing, of erasing, of uprooting. That's something that is going on all the time.
Yeah.
There was a wonderful woman that I don't know whether you're familiar with her name, Simone Weil.
I recognize the name, but explain briefly to us who it is.
Simone Weil, she was a very nice woman and great French philosopher. She died of TBC, of tuberculosis, and of starvation in England in 1944. Mm. She wrote, she was of Jewish origin, but she, rejected Judaism very, very strongly. She did not want to become a member of Catholic Church because in her way, in her understanding, she wrote, the Catholic Church is too Jewified.
Hmm.
You can understand. She wrote, for instance, some very comforting, words about Adolf Hitler. She said that Adolf Hitler is basically Descartes who was read to the end.
What does that mean? I don't understand that.
Descartes, the great French philosopher who died in Sweden, Cartesian philosopher.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, that's right.
She said that Hitlerism is Cartesian thought which was brought to its ultimate end.
Really?
Yeah.
Would you agree with that?
Well, we don't have to really go into it now.
Okay.
But anyway, I just say, but one of her most important books is called Uprooting. And she basically speaks about a terrible process of people being uprooted. That, I think, is the book that everyone who is interested in the subject, what we speak about,
should
really read. And that would be very interesting. And if we speak about Jews, she said in the same book, she said that Jews are the very poison of uprooting, the essence of uprooting. But she obviously did not think, nor do I think, that Jews are the only people who do it.
Sure, sure, of course.
You understand what I try to say.
And obviously, Israel, nothing uproots like war, right? So when we have all these Western powers going into the Middle East and other countries, Northern Africa now and elsewhere, obviously, historically, people are uprooted because they have to flee from that. And in most regards, then, You get many waves of immigration to Europe as a consequence of that. So in one way, if the Western countries are supporters of these war, obviously they are doing this to themselves, right? It's a cycle. It's just not happening, if I put it that way.
Very true. Very true what you say. Now, for instance, the Western NATO bombs Libya, and so many Libyans will come to live to Sweden. Let's face it, not only Libyans, but also black Africans will also come up to Sweden. And I think it would be very difficult for a Swede, let's say for you or for me, or whatever, to tell to those people, go away, because they would say, you don't want me to come, don't bomb my home.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, exactly. Since Sweden is now lining up, at least our politicians, I mean, they never asked us, of course, the people, what we think of this, but when everybody in the Swedish parliament were singing from the song sheet, as it were, of, yep, we have to go into Libya, no questions asked, do it now. And then, of course, they sent their JAWS, Gripen, you know, the fighter jets down to support NATO, then of course we're responsible. The politicians are, and in the extension, even the Swedish people are, because we haven't thrown these suckers out of parliament that is doing this without asking us for the approval.
Yes, that's very true. And I fully agree with what you say, but just one short remark. There is practically not a single party, I think, in Sweden which would speak strongly against it. I don't know, from the far right, from Swedish Democrats to the far left, to the Vänsterpartiet, I don't think there is, you hear one single voice that would be strongly against the war in Afghanistan, that would be strongly against interference in Libya.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a problem that we don't have it.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. There's no... In these kinds of situations, they all seem to rally behind each other. And again, my question is, are they doing that because somebody is telling them behind the scenes, you know, or are they just simply so gullible that they get fooled by some of the propaganda that we saw in terms of what was happening in Libya before NATO troops got in there?
That is one of those very, very complicated questions, and I don't think that we would be able to answer it explicitly.
Yeah.
Very difficult. I mean, how could we possibly know whether there is a person who lifts a telephone and who speaks to Swedish Prime Minister saying, well, we are both members of the same kind of sinister union. We want now Swedish people being completely swelled away by waves of Africans coming there as immigrants. And for this reason, let us bomb Libya now.
Yeah.
For instance, did such conversation ever take place? Or did both sides thought that it is a possible idea? Well, you know, it's very difficult to answer this question. I think we could, you know, expect we can always say that, let's say, the satanic force, in a way, if you want to speak it in such terms, obviously is behind it. But whether there are people who go all the way with it, well, that's also possible.
Mm. Absolutely. Well, we've talked about many different topics here, obviously, and I wish that we had more time, and maybe we can do this at another point as well, of course, because it's time to round things up for now, obviously. But why don't you just mention a little bit about your website, of course. You write extensively, and you have some material out there as well. Just talk a little bit about your website and how people can go there and what they will find on your website.
Yes, you can find things on my website. That is www.israelshamir.net or .com is the same. And there are many things in Swedish. And then you can always find one book of mine was translated into Swedish. That is Galilee Flowers was translated into Swedish. That's something that kind of I'm very happy about. And on my website in English, you can find some more of my books. And anyway, I am kind of, you know, basically I'm alive still, yet, whatever. And I'm always ready to speak to people as we speak now and to encourage them to preserve their beautiful traditional culture, not to give it up, to preserve traditional values, which I think are of very great importance. And let's say, from this point of view, yes, God bless Sweden.
Thank you for joining us today, Israel. We really appreciate your input, perspective, and views on these topics. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Henrik, and we shall hear each other again eventually. With pleasure. Thank you. Bye.
We will announce our winners to our music quiz on our website. If you have been following this series, you know that we are looking for a four-letter word. The clues are in the music that we play at the end, four tunes, and of course we're looking for a four-letter word. If you think you know the word, you can still send an email to redeyescreations@gmail.com. But hurry up, we're ending the quiz soon. Keep an eye on the website for new and upcoming programs coming your way. Josh Reeves, Dolores Cannon, Lindy Cowling, John Lash, Andy Lloyd, David Hatcher, Childress, and Brian Forrester. Also, Christopher Knight and Alan Butler, to name a few. Thank you for listening today and to this series, redeyescreations.com.